Hi, and welcome to another Glenn and Helen podcast. This week, we're back with our military experts, Austin Bay of AustinBay.net and Jim Dunnigan of StrategyPage.com.
We'll also be talking to blogger Michael Totten of MichaelTotten.com, who's been reporting firsthand from Lebanon and Iraq. He's back in the States, and we'll hear what he has to say.
We've got Jim Dunnigan and Austin Bay on the phone now.
Hi, thanks to both of you for joining us today. My first question to you is, China's president, Hu Jintao, was visiting the United States this week. What's the state of the relationship between us and China, and should we be worried?
Well, the relationship is murky. That's the problem. And the main problem is in China, not the United States. You got to remember, China is still a communist dictatorship. They took the very innovative role of not dropping the communism, but adopting a market economy. They've grafted this market economy onto a communist government. And they don't quite know what to do with it or where it's going to go, and neither does anybody else.
I'd use the word complicated. Murky's a great word, but it's the U.S.-Chinese relationship is extremely complicated. Take a look. Isn't it a gimme hat that President Hu was got from Boeing? Of course, he met with Bill Gates. And look at the relationships that China has with Google and Yahoo. China has a very complex and sometimes murky relationship with the Internet. And in some ways, the Internet is a metaphor for some of China's other problems. They need the Internet for modernity, communications, and the like. They even somewhere, I think, the senior leadership in Beijing sees it as a propaganda tool. Yet at the same time, the Internet does what? It opens up, it's individualizing, it empowers armies of Davids, I think, Glenn, is a,
ooh,
is
catchy
a phrase, that, I, that,
catchy
I, that I've heard in the past. And there's, as Jim said, hey, they've grafted on communist authoritarianism and totalitarianism onto a market economy, trying to get balance a best of both worlds, and yet what is the best of authoritarianism? I really don't know quite what it is. They think that there's ways to command, and there is to a certain limit. They want the golden goose of capitalism, but what grows out of that wealth are demands for liberalism.
Does the average person in China have a computer?
I think they have over 100 million internet users now.
Is that right?
Population. Yeah.
Is that right? There's 100
million? And
that's
including people who go to the internet cafe, which
wow.
a lot do. So that's why you have a lot of people. You have several. I think you have 300 million cell phone users. They are basically the new frontier of electronics on a mass scale. The main problem they have is that there is a tendency for the government, which is very nervous because they have corruption. You know, they're trying to run a police state, as Austin pointed out, in the midst of a market economy, which breeds democracy and all sorts of anti-authoritarian, things. And the communist bosses, as it were, are using nationalism. They've been using nationalism for over a decade. They found that it worked, and they say, well, let's run with this. The trouble is, when you start using nationalism, basically pointing out to the Chinese people that we have made China great again. Now, what makes me as a historian nervous was this was the Germans were doing 100 years ago. We need our place in the sun. The Germans have been, spat upon for thousands of years. It's our turn. And you're hearing a lot of the same stuff out of China. Now, how far they want to take this, nobody knows. Right now, the old saying in China is it's glorious to be rich, and most Chinese are obsessed with that. But we saw in early 2001 when we had that collision between the Chinese fighter and the American P-3 patrol plane, that got a lot of juices flowing in China, and that was kind of scary. And that's what, first made me believe what I've been hearing from my Chinese contacts, that was that people are really waving the flag a little too enthusiastically.
Well, this is a technique of dictatorships that are uncertain. If you want to talk about priming the nationalist pump, we're seeing it in Iran. I've talked about the Galtieri government in Argentina and the attack on the Falklands, Las Malvinas in 1982 as an analog to some of the things that are going on in Iran. But that was a reach for a priming the nationalist pump on the Argentinian autocratic regime, military regime, that's the word I was after, the military regime, they were losing domestic support. They had an economy going down the drain. And so let's start a war and prey upon historical grievance. China's historical grievance is that, hey, wait a minute. At one time, we were the Middle Kingdom. We were the center of the earth. We were a civil, to be Chinese meant to be civilized. Somewhere during the decay, suddenly there are these Brits there running Hong Kong and dealing opium. Well, we've got to, selling us opium. Now we've got to rectify that historical wrong. Now, as Jim says, though, there are a lot of this big streak of pragmatism on the part of the Chinese that they look and say, wait a minute, do I want to be a poor peasant waving a nationalist flag, or would I rather be kind of wealthy, be able to have a car, my own cell phone, an internet connection, buy some foster grants, and kind of enjoy life? And if you move to that, that's, I'm not saying that you're being paid off with the materialism. Actually, the Chinese communist bosses, I think, hope that they would be bought off. But what tends to go along after you reach this material level of reasonable wealth is the next demand is, gee, I'd like to decide things for myself. And they're trying to avoid that.
And they're already running into problems with religion. Now, they've always had a minor problem with religion, but historically, the Chinese leadership, the emperors, as it were always leery of religion. Many of the most damaging civil wars and rebellions were based upon religions, often new religions. You know, the Taiping Rebellion.
Killed
over 20 million people. And so World War II, it was the most ruinous and had the highest body count of any war in history. And they saw Falun Gong, as one Chinese told me, more yellow turbans. The yellow turbans was one, you know, in the 18th century, a famous religious-based, revolutionary group. And the Chinese communist leaders are very history conscious, as are most educated Chinese. And when they look over their shoulders, they don't see, Eastern Europe in 1989. They see, the Taiping Rebellion and the yellow turbans and a long, long line of, successful revolutions based upon religious ideas. But they look upon democracy as just another, religion that they have to be afraid of.
Leading to that, why isn't China then more worried about a nuclear-armed Iran and about the threat of radical Islam?
Well, they actually are concerned about radical Islam, and there's a ethnic cleansing issue at work here vis-a-vis China and their their ethnic Turks, Central Asians out in Xinjiang province. Now, on Tuesday of this week, I think it was, Glenn, I watched on C-SPAN, I flipped on the TV, and there was a Uyghur woman, that's usually spelled, I think, and I'm sitting here in the Army Navy Club, it's U-I-G-H-U-R, isn't that the way it's usually spelled in English, Jim?
Yeah.
Uyghur is how it's pronounced, but there was a Uyghur woman testifying, I believe it was before a House committee, had a translator there. He looked like a young Chinese translator, actually, but translating from her language into English. And she was talking about what has been going on over the last three decades. I might stretch it back really like 35 to 40 years, and it's called Sinicization, actually moving Han Chinese out into Western China, into Xinjiang.
Think of the Borg. I mean, the Chinese were doing that several thousand years ago.
Well,
why kill you off when we can just basically absorb you into the Han, gene pool?
Well, they're doing it. They did it in Tibet or in the process.
They're doing it in
Tibet.
They've done it many, many times before. And in the past, the people who did not want to be absorbed simply fled. And if you look around the periphery of China, especially down in on the Vietnamese border where the climate's somewhat better, you have literally dozens of tribes who can trace their origins back to central and northern China. These are the people who, wouldn't go along. So they simply fled en masse. Well, there's nowhere to go anymore.
Well,
where the Uyghurs are, in the middle of nowhere.
Well, in the Uyghurs' case, though, they have an Islamist contingency among the Uyghurs because who was going to help them? The only people that they could find with money to give them guns, contact, ideology, and they are Muslim people, were Islamic political radicals. Now, the Chinese have taken the fact that there were some Uyghurs scattered throughout some of the Islamist groups that were in Afghanistan, and apparently at least handfuls of them were being trained by Al-Qaeda or operating with the Taliban.
Yeah, we found Uyghur bodies in Afghanistan.
That's right.
But the thing is, it's a matter of proportion. It's a small number of radicals among the Uyghur population, and the Uyghur population is tiny among the Chinese population.
Right. And they are, when I use the term ethnic cleansing, that's the way the Uyghurs argue it, and I think that's a fair argument to make. They say, take a look at our situation, what is happening to us out in Western China. We're totally off the map. If you want to accuse us of being Islamist terrorists, that's a real reach, but that's the way Beijing approaches it. And
it's hard for Americans to appreciate that, because the idea of America is based upon absorbing other people into a new entity. So ethnic cleansing, you know, although we can understand that, when it's done brutally, but basically we do it all the time. You bring your ethnicity to the United States, and two generations later, your grandparents won't recognize you.
Well, the Uyghurs, though, are doing something, Jim, that the Native American argument says is that we didn't bring it to the United States. The Han
exactly.
are bringing it into Xinjiang.
Exactly. But again, the Chinese look upon 3,000 years of Chinese history and say, what's the problem?
Well, are the Chinese looking at pushback from places like Iran or Saudi Arabia or other powers in the region?
China is looking at those places as the Chinese empress. China is the center of the universe. They know they have 1 billion people. They know they have an economy that's been growing 10% for, 20, 30 years now, and eventually they're going to be the biggest economy on the planet. Who cares is their attitude. How can we exploit these foreigners? They have nothing for us. I mean, this is classic, Chinese attitude. I'm a student of Chinese history, and it's such a deja vu to it. That is good news and bad news. I mean, it means you can do business with them. But, never underestimate, what their attitudes are. They're looking at you from the center of the universe.
Well, Jim, what about unrestricted warfare? Again, off the top of my head, I don't remember the names of the two men.
The two colonels.
Pardon?
The two colonels.
That's right.
And of course, who is passing out copies of Sun Tzu? That is nothing new with China. I mean, it's interesting. That unrestricted warfare, if you're familiar with Sun Tzu, you'll see a lot of parallels. In fact, it's Sun Tzu, repackaged for the late 20th century.
It's unrestricted warfare, though. Is it, who's the Chinese enemy implicit in unrestricted warfare?
I think they did that mainly to get the book published.
Oh, to make it the United States?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, remember, it's the communist dictatorship.
Sure.
Never forget that.
That's right. It is, but yeah, I think your read on that about lots and lots of rebaked Sun Tzu is accurate.
Works. Yeah. I mean, that's the one thing. That's why American military people started to get into Sun Tzu after Vietnam. They said, hey, there's other ways to do this. Although when you look at the history of American warfare, even without knowing about Sun Tzu, we reinvented him. Americans always apply equal doses of ignorance and imagination to things like warfare. And that's how we've come up with a lot of weird things, which tended to work.
Well,
let's move on to Iraq now. What's going on there, and are we moving towards a political deal?
Opportunity.
Yeah, well, the thing you got to remember about Iraq, it's a typical Arab country. And if you think about if you want to know what's going to happen next, look at all the other Arab countries in the Middle East, and you'll see that when the dictator is falling, there's a great deal of competition for who's going to be the next dictator. What's spoiling all of this is the fact that you've got a democracy. Now, most Arabs go along with the idea of democracy. They've just never been able to, I shouldn't say that. It's not entirely the fact that they have not been able to do it. They did it in Lebanon. They're back on track again. But they do have this fascistness, which is much more intense than it is in other parts of the world. They don't like... Compromise doesn't come easily to people in the Middle East. And I've sat down over dinner, with people from the Middle East, senior type people, and said this to their face, and they just shrug. And they say, well, that's our way. Why give in?
Yeah, but here's the situation, though, in Iraq is one of those moments where they've got the opportunity for demonstrating illustrating some of the changes that are or have occurred in Iraq.
Yes, but the problem is you have a fairly significant and well-armed minority that doesn't agree.
Well, it's the Al-Sisi regime, though.
And it's not just the Sunni Arabs. You have there's a segments like Bader, the Bader gang, and the Seder. The Baders and the Seders, I like to call them, who are heavily armed and both believe in a religious dictatorship. So while the majority is for democracy, they have to basically suppress those violent minorities that still want a dictatorship.
Well, we got into a little bit of a discussion in another podcast, actually, that Glenn and I were on about the Interior Ministry, the Iraqi Interior Ministry, as being
the Ministry of Dirty Deeds.
Well, but the thing is, though, is that one of the other folks on this. This was a Pajamas Media podcast that we did, but. I tried to point out that the Interior Ministry can't ever get good press, because when they go into a Shia neighborhood, they're accused of doing the work for the Sunnis, and when they go into a Sunni neighborhood, they're accused of doing the work for the Shias. You know,
well, they must be doing their job.
Yeah, because that's the point is that they're trying to establish street credibility over, and I think in the last 6 to 8 weeks, primarily over Muqtada Sadr's Mahdi militia. But that's
another Middle Eastern characteristic you have to keep in mind is that people there know how to work the media. I mean, Saddam, was a past master at that. So these guys will always know, the bad guys, more so than the good guys, they always know who to run to, what media outlet to go to give them their spin, knowing that their spin will then be spun out over the satellite networks, and they're going to get, traction somewhere in the world. And to a certain extent, you have to ignore that. I mean, that's why on Strategy Page, we try and give you the news, straight down the middle, like the man from Mars. We don't know from all the games you're playing, but this is best we can tell is what's happening. And it's interesting, some people say we're right-wing, some people say we're left-wing, and then they change over, after a while. They can't quite figure us out. But that's what happens when you report, down the line. I mean, that's why I think Mark Twain once said, if you tell the truth, half the people will believe you, half the people will think you're liars, and the other people, the other half. Or anyway, it was one of those jokes pointing out that, telling the truth doesn't always have the desired effect.
I'll give readers of Strategy Page a little hint about some of the things that, when Jim's the editor, and how the analysis works to a great deal on Strategy Page, is that the people doing the work, Jim, me, a few others, we see a lot of these guys as really being tribes and gangs, and they have yet to let us down because, for most part, that's the way they operate. Inside, it's our gang who wants to be on top, and to a large degree, the former regime element, or the members of Saddam Hussein's former government and high-ranking military from the old Saddamist army are behaving as a gang. They just want their gang back in charge.
And of course, another thing I point out, which the mainstream media never seem to pick up on,
it's not politics.
Most,
it's money.
Well, no. Most of these guys, the Sunni Arab supremacists, I guess we could call them, the old Saddam gang, a lot of them are war criminals. And, this doesn't, for somehow, I hear this from Iraqis all the time. The Iraqis have lists. They have names. The Saddam thugs didn't hide their identities when they were doing their dirty work.
Good point.
And these guys know that eventually they see what happens to Milosevic and there's all this war crimes nonsense, these crazy Europeans, but they see themselves in the dock sometime. And what keeps the war going is the fact that the mid-rank thugs are really afraid that eventually somebody's going to work down the list to them. And that's why they're trying to cut deals about,
amnesty,
for some of the lower ranking and there have been arguments, which I don't think the Times or anybody else has picked it up. And the arguments are over is, well, how far down do we have to go? At what level do we, give you a get out of jail free card? But that's what it really comes down to for a lot of these people, because that's their future.
Major,
or lack of their lack.
You go down to major and lieutenant colonel as long as you're in the regular army, unless you happen to be an intel officer or a police officer.
Well, actually, they're arguing about fairly senior people. In other words, how many do we have to sacrifice for the rest of us to get off scot free? I mean, they're still going to have a problem with families of Kurdish or Shia Arab families coming looking for them. But they feel that if they got the war crimes trials indictments off their backs, you know, there's just one less thing to worry about.
I understand there's a fair amount of anti-Iranian sentiment in Iraq still, and I wonder how far that is likely to go.
Well, that's very important. Because, again, Iran has been the big guy, the bully, so to speak, in the neighborhood for thousands of years. They never really took the Arabs seriously. The Arabs defeated them only once, and that's, you know, in Mohammed's time. And that's because the Iranians had worn themselves out with civil wars and fighting the Byzantines. So they caught them when their guard was down, and I think they've never recovered from that. So the Arabs are always in mortal fear of Iranian domination and conquest. And, of course, in the past, especially the Arabs in Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, there was nothing there for the Iranians to come looking for. But now there's oil. And so the Arabs are really, you know, sitting there, you know, fearful that if their American allies desert them, which, of course, we won't because we need the oil, too. But, hey, if the Iranians turn around and say, hey, you know, we'll give you a better deal on the oil than the Arabs do, they have all these nightmares which have a tinge of reality to them. And that's why the Shia Arabs in Iraq fought against the Iranians for Saddam. Think about that. He never had, you know, rebellion problems in his army when he was at war with Iran. That tells you a lot. And that attitude hasn't changed.
There is Iranian influence and Iranian influence.
Oh, there's influence, but it's more religious than, you know.
Well, but the thing is that I believe that some of the accusations about Sadr's Mahdi militia, at least some of the lieutenants being, whether...
Oh, definitely. No, and especially with the Skiri, the Bader gang. But the thing is, they're never going to get a lot of traction. They're never going to get a mass following because the majority of Iraquis do not want to be dominated by the Iranians.
I completely agree with that. That's the enemy on the other side of the river.
Yes. And the Iranians are worried that they're going to have it done to them because most of their oil is in that part of Iran that is mostly populated by Arabs.
Arabistan, if you're an Arab, or Khuzestan, if you're Iranian. I think that's the province. Look, Iran's got the issue of a real competitive Arab state in Mesopotamia. If Iraq does get its act together, has the United States as an ally, and you know, there's some degree of, as long as we keep Iraq embroiled in fighting itself, that buys us time. And I've also thought that some of the reasons the Iranians want to bomb, for a lot of reasons, I mean, just without going into touching on every single other one, which we touched on some in one of our last conversations with Glenn and Helen, is that it's also a break on growing Iraqi military power 5 to 10 years in the future. At least I'm trying to look at that from an Iranian perspective.
Well, the thing the Iranians are more concerned about, I think, is closer to home, and that is democracy.
Their own people,
The majority realize, not everyone, you know, about 30% of the population backs, you know, the religious dictatorship that is now in power. But the majority of the people would like their prosperity, their freedom, their democracy back. But because they still remember the bloody war with Iraq in the 1980s and all the religious terror, it's almost like a replay of the French Revolution, you know, after that. There's no great enthusiasm for having another revolution. That might change. You know, now they've, for example, just this week, they brought in another 200 morality police to go after women. There are women who are not, they're wearing the chadors too tight, you know, showing a little ankle. I mean, literally, that's what they're talking about. And so maybe the women will lead the revolution.
Well, and you've got a lot of inflation in Iran, I've noticed all of a sudden, and there's a run on gold there. I wonder if that tells us something.
That they don't know how to run their economy. Got to remember, you got a bunch of religious bigots running the economy. And they've made all manner of mistakes. And any time you get a technocrat, in other words, somebody who stayed awake during, you know, economics class, in there, he gets into religious problems. Just they start bringing up Quranic references, well, you can't do this, you can't do that. And what they're mainly talking about, hey, I want to steal some money from my cousin so he can open up a new business. They have a tremendous problem with the corruption, because basically the senior religious people are taking care of their families at the expense of the state. And even with $70 oil, there's not enough grass to go around.
Well, I know.
So, I mean, that's a bomb waiting to go off. Never mind the nuclear bomb they may eventually get. They're going to have a social bomb blowing up in their faces. And that's their big problem. That's what really bothers them. But they have no natural enemies. They're the top of the food chain in that part of the world. So they are mainly, the enemy they have to worry about is the one they can see in the mirror.
Well, let me ask you, we talked about this in a previous podcast, but there's a lot of talk about U.S. military action against Iran. I know you think that's premature. What, if anything, are we doing short of that, or what should we be doing?
We're trying to help the revolution. We've said some of it openly, the idea of making these contributions to these NGOs that go in there and try and help with the revolution. Now, it's hard to do in Iran because you get arrested, you go in there and start openly talking about, an infidel going in there, or even a foreign Muslim going in and talking openly about democracy. That all gets thrown in jail. Or worse, I mean, there was that Canadian gal who was murdered, several years ago, a Canadian journalist. Actually, she was Islamic, she was born in Iran. But neither, the Canadians were not amused. But they will do that to you if you go in there and try and do it openly. But there are various covert ways that it can be done, and apparently these are being pursued. Some are more covert than others. But basically it comes down to getting the Iranians to, develop a little backbone. Democracy is not given, it has to be taken. And they have to understand that.
Well, we've budgeted openly $85 million. I think that's the figure that the State Department
has crossed out. What I'm concerned about is how much is budgeted covertly.
That was where you picked up exactly where I was going to go next. There's that open budget, and then there's that closed-door covert budget. Here is the danger to the mullahs. Iran is an educated nation. It's an able nation. It's a historically aware nation, and one of the things is they're situationally aware as well. Internet penetration, still reasonably easy for Iranian expatriates to go home, visit the family, visit cousins, buy a few rugs, and fly back to Great Britain or fly back to the United States or wherever it is they may be, living. And just a quick aside, I've spoken to a half dozen Iranian friends or acquaintances, a couple of them recently back from Iran, and all of them say, hey, the word I get is you don't know how bad it is economically and how much they hate the mullahs. Okay, you've got, read that anecdotally, but also read the election results, from a few years ago with the kind of numbers that President Khatami pulled, he was the liberal candidate, and you know that conditions are there for a type of people's revolution, a democratic revolution. But as Jim says, the issue is spine and willingness to fight for it, because with the Pasa Daran and their secret police, they have the ability to shoot, exile, arrest individuals acting on their own. Where the assistance needs to be, and of course the State Department knows this, CIA knows this, the Iranians, the Indians know this, is helping them to coordinate and act collectively. And what is missing, and this is repeating something I remember Jim said on a podcast a couple of podcasts ago, is there a central individual? Is there one, two, or three charismatic leaders? There was Khomeini. Is there an equivalent? Is there an Iranian Churchill out there?
There have been a number, but they tend to get jailed very quickly.
Or they're outside, or they said, well, you've been gone too long, or you have monarchist connections. That's another one that crops up.
And remember, it's a religious police state, so if anybody becomes too troublesome, they disappear.
Well, let me just, I want to ask one question. I think I know the answer on this, but and then if you want, we'll let you wrap up with a couple of final observations. I actually heard Frank Gaffney on Hugh Hewitt's show the other day, and he claimed that Iran was planning to develop an electromagnetic pulse weapon that would shut down everything electronic in America. And it strikes me they're awfully far from that. Don't you need a thermonuclear weapon to do that kind of damage?
No, there are allegedly electro-EMP weapons available. The Brits have apparently taken the lead in developing those. But it's sort of like a unicorn, much talked about, but never seen. I've had people tell me with a straight face that they really exist. But quite frankly, until I actually see one in action, I'll keep my counsel.
What's the threat there? They're going to knock out all of our computers? Is that it?
They would come after our computers. Hit us where we really live.
Yeah, that's it. Okay.
No more podcasts.
It's funny with the Islamic radicals. As much as they talk about living in the 14th century, they love their gadgets. I think the mullahs would also be aware of the fact that EMP goes both ways. And they would be reluctant to do that. A lot of the stuff they say is purely for internal consumption, you know, rah-rah, you know, morale building. There was that thing recently when they had all these military maneuvers a few weeks ago in Iran, and it got into the Western media, and they were talking about, oh, we have this 200-mile-an-hour torpedo, this new rocket. Well, it was all BS. And we did some pieces and strategy page pointing out, showing where it's coming from and what it actually is. And they have a fairly extensive track record of this kind of BS, you know, press release. But their base, as it were, who are less educated, tend to be rural in Iran, they eat this stuff up and they have no way of finding out that it's false.
Well, there's one other component to this too. Don't underestimate the ego blast that some of these guys at the top get. They love being on international television.
Oh, yeah.
You say the outrageous, yeah. and outrageous, they get TV time, and they know that there's...
Well, that works in the United States as well.
I'm sorry?
That works in the United States.
Oh, that works for every politician
our media business would fall apart
when they get into promising the extermination of another country.
Jerry Springer simply won extreme, you know, aspect of that.
Well, is Jerry Springer running the United States?
No, but he's running Iran, I think.
Well, later we'll find out down the road that Jerry Springer had a secret media consulting contract with the Iranians.
Was he mayor of Cincinnati?
Yeah, at one point.
I think he's running for office. He's actually a pretty bright guy.
Well, often
I
know
you're... People who say, you know, I can actually do this crazy thing and it'll work. And he was right.
Austin, I know you're about out of time.
Yeah.
Austin's been kind enough to join us by phone from the Army-Navy Club in
Washington, D.C. That's right. We're about to do the military blog conference on Saturday, April 22nd.
We should have sent you a recorder and had you do podcast interviews.
Well, there are going to be plenty of folks there, and we're hoping that some of this is going to be covered online. I don't know now. I understand that MSNBC may not be covering it like they claim they were. Glenn, we'll put that on this podcast, and let's see if they show up tomorrow.
Well, listen, thank you guys so much for joining us, and we look forward to having you back again.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Michael Totten blogs at michaeltotten.com. Lately, he's been blogging from Lebanon, Egypt, and Iraq. His reporting was supported by his readers, and I think it's some of the very best work coming out of that region. He's here to talk about how he did it and what he's learned. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Glenn. How are you?
Doing just great.
Hi. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks, Helen.
So, Michael, what made you decide to head off to the Mideast and do independent journalism?
Well, when I first went out there, I had no real intention of trying to raise money from my readers. What I was intending to do was to do freelance journalism for more mainstream media outlets. And I'd asked for assignments from various places, and nobody wanted to pay my expenses to go out to the Middle East and do any reporting. Basically, the answer I kept hearing was, just go out and be in the Middle East for a while, and then we'll take a look at your story ideas from there. So that's what I first did, and I did publish some freelance pieces. And then when I went to northern Iraq, the Kurdistan region, I decided to try an experiment to see if I could make as much money raising money from readers. And as it turns out, I made more money raising money from readers than I did from regular paid work. Now, that doesn't mean I got rich from raising money from readers, because as you, Glenn probably knows at least, mainstream journalism doesn't pay very well at all. And freelance journalism doesn't pay expenses. So I actually did pretty well raising money from readers. And so I think what I'm going to do from here is continue to do that for a while and see if I can keep the momentum going. It's hard to say if I can continue doing this because there's only so many people who are ever willing to give me some money, and this may dry up at some point.
What was your day job prior to this? What was your day job? Were you a journalist?
or?
Well, my day job, 2 years ago, I was a technical writer in the high-tech industry.
Okay.
And it was finally my turn to get laid off. And I was kind of ready to be laid off anyway and do something else. So that was fine. I had no complaints there.
And your first reporting was from Tunisia, wasn't it, in fact?
Yes, it was. And that was just regular paid work, although I didn't have expenses paid. I actually took a loss on that. But I was going to Tunisia just for fun anyway, so the fact that I recuperated some money from that was fine. I didn't go there specifically to work. I went there with my wife for fun and thought, well, maybe I should, you know, write something about this place while I'm here anyway.
And then you went to Libya.
I did, yes.
Which is
for the LA Weekly.
Yeah, and then so you've kind of gotten around step by step. Most people see places like Lebanon and Iraq as really grim and dangerous, but as I recall, you actually found Cairo to be the most depressing place on your trip. Is that right?
Cairo was the most depressing place I went, and I'd heard lots of bad things about Cairo, that it's too big and it's loud and it's dirty and it's poor, and for some reason I expected to like it anyway. Actually, I think I know why I expected to like it anyway, because I've traveled around lots of places like that in Latin America and have liked everywhere I've been. And so I just sort of figured that I would think similarly about Egypt. But I didn't, and it took me a while to figure out why exactly. And I think the reason is because Egypt seems to me to be getting worse, not better.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of something I read from P.J. O'Rourke one time. He remarked that he'd been in all these poor third world countries where people were much, much poorer than the people in the housing projects in the South Bronx, but that the housing projects in the South Bronx were a lot worse because they were just so hopeless and depressing.
Yeah, I think that's a really important observation, because when I go to a poor country, if people around me there seem to be happy, then I don't feel too bad for them for living in a poor place, because money is absolutely not everything. And most places, actually everywhere I think I've been in Latin America, is improving rather than getting worse. So it's easy to go there and say, okay, there's all these problems, but 10 years from now it's probably going to be better, so I don't feel too bad about it. But if I had to guess where Egypt's going to be in 10 years, I would say it's going to be worse than it is right now.
What's the cause of that? Or did you get any feeling for it? Is it the people? Is it what?
Well, there's a whole bunch of factors with Egypt. I mean, they've had the same military dictatorship for about half a century now. And the economy continues to get worse. And the biggest opposition to Mubarak's government, unfortunately, is the Muslim Brotherhood. And there are liberal movements opposed to both, but they're really small and marginalized. And the secular liberal Egyptians that I spoke to, they were uniformly pessimistic, and they wanted to get out of the country because they didn't see any way out. That, according to them, the change they expect to see happen is that Mubarak's government's going to fall at some point, and it's going to be replaced by an Islamist government. And they may be wrong, but they know the country better than I do, and that's what they thought. And it didn't look good.
Yeah, you had a pretty depressing conversation with an Egyptian blogger. I think it was Big Pharaoh.
Yeah.
Who kind of saw Egypt having to go through 20 years of Iranian-style fundamentalism before people realized how much they hated that?
Yeah, that's pretty much his take on it. And I was kind of worried about that myself, and he just sort of confirmed my worries for me. Although I will say, and he agrees also, that if Egypt does have an Islamist government replace the current one, it's not going to be probably as fanatical as the one in Iran, just because the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is not what I would call moderate. But compared to the mullahs on the Guardian Council, it's moderate.
That's an easy standard to beat, I guess.
It is, yeah. And Big Pharaoh was worried that that was sort of actually his nightmare scenario, because if Egypt gets an Islamist government that's not completely insane, then there wouldn't be enough opposition to it to get rid of it.
Ah. That's kind of depressing. It certainly is. Well, how were you received as an American in Lebanon and Iraq?
Oh, very well everywhere. Everywhere I went, I was, I mean, Middle Easterners are the friendliest people in the world that I've ever met, by far, overwhelmingly. And it doesn't matter really what their political opinions are. I mean, I met lots of pro-American people, lots of anti-American people, but they do a better job of separating, politics from personal relationships than Westerners do.
That's something we could stand to see more of in the blogosphere.
Yeah, absolutely.
What were your impressions of the state of Iraqi Kurdistan? And I noticed you crossing from Turkish Kurdistan into northern Iraq, it was quite a dramatic change.
Yeah, Turkish Kurdistan is a complete disaster. I was really surprised by how bad a shape it's in. They had a civil war there in eastern Turkey for a long time, and it supposedly ended 6-7 years ago. I'm not sure how many years ago. The thing is, it hasn't completely ended. It's not full-pitched battle the way it used to be. But there is still quite a terrorism problem in Turkey from the Kurdish PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is Marxist-Leninist. And it's not at the really extreme level that it was, but it's still a serious problem. And I was in Turkish Kurdistan just a couple weeks ago, and there have been several terrorist incidents just since then. And the Turkish military is not at all subtle in how they put this down in eastern Turkey. And they really have the place under siege. I mean, economically, the place, it has no economy at all. And it's just completely devastated. And I saw one utterly destroyed village after another from the car just driving on the main highway. I mean, I don't know how many, 15, 16 villages that were completely annihilated. And I saw maybe the same number of villages that were still intact. So half the ones I drove through were just destroyed. I don't know when they were destroyed. It's impossible to say. I don't think it was probably last week, but it was probably when the war was more serious.
You know,
it's still grim.
Several years ago, and it was back before September 11th, in fact, I sat on an airplane next to a Marine, I think it was, who was coming back from some sort of service on one of the U.S. bases in Turkey. And I just remember him saying, Turkey is a lot worse than most Americans realize. He said, you know, when you're in Istanbul and Ankara, it looks great. And he loved Istanbul, which I think you did too. But he said out in the boonies, there were a lot more problems than people generally realize. And he was kind of down on the place.
Well, I drove from one end to the other, and I took two different ways each time I did it. And I don't quite agree with his characterization. I would say eastern Turkey is a complete disaster. But if you're talking about the ethnically Turkish parts of the country, in the boonies, so to speak, no, they're not doing as well as Istanbul is. But then again, if you're going to drive out of New York City into some random small town in upstate New York, it's not going to be Manhattan. It couldn't possibly be. And you get the same sort of situation in Turkey where the rural areas are much more conservative and they don't have as much money and it's not as culturally interesting. But I wouldn't describe, at least from the point of view of driving through in the car, okay, it's hard to say. I didn't stop and hang out in these places. But it didn't look so bad to me at all, honestly. And I found most of western and central Turkey to be actually very nice, whether we're talking about large cities or small.
Yeah, I know you loved Istanbul, and of course Claire Berlinski loves Istanbul.
Istanbul is amazing. It's a world-class city.
Everybody I know who goes there goes on about how great it is.
Yeah, I knew lots of people who've been there too, and I expected to really love it, and I loved it more than I thought I would. It's just really an incredible place. I would recommend anybody go there before they go to, say, Rome. Because they have as much amazing things as Rome has, but it's cheaper and people are friendlier.
Michael, there's you, Michael Yon, Bill Ruggiero, and others doing this kind of reader-supported independent journalism. Do you think we'll see more of it?
I imagine so. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think so. I'm the fourth person that I'm aware of to raise money from readers and go to Iraq. And apparently, all four of us who have done this have made enough money to cover all expenses plus some. And so I don't see any reason why a fifth person couldn't do this as well.
Well, I think what's interesting is so many people think that bloggers just sit home in their pajamas and they say they're not very brave, but I think it's a really brave thing. I mean, we see, people talk about Bob Woodruff or Daniel Pearl or other journalists that go over, but we've got, you know, four of you going over and doing this kind of thing, and I think it's, I hope there are more in the future, but it's amazing to me that people think that bloggers aren't brave because obviously they are.
Well, Michael Yon certainly is brave. I mean, he was a war correspondent blogging combat, and I didn't do that.
Right, we had him on one of our shows a couple podcasts back, I guess.
But he is trained as a combat soldier,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not. But also, I only went to Iraq for a couple of weeks, and nobody really goes to Iraq and embeds with the military for 2 weeks. That's the sort of project that you have to spend a lot more time on than I had. And if I were to go to, say, Baghdad by myself without being embedded, I would have absolutely no choice but to hire security guards, my own private bodyguard. I don't have enough money to do that, so it really wasn't an option for me at all. And going to northern Iraq, I mean, it sounds scary to people who don't know what northern Iraq is like, but honestly, it wasn't dangerous.
Of course, that's one of the big items of news that you bring that we don't hear about from all the Baghdad-based correspondents. You almost never hear anything about northern Iraq because not enough stuff blows up there.
No, it's true. It would actually be very difficult to be based as a journalist in northern Iraq and file daily reports because there are no daily reports coming out of northern Iraq.
It'd be like reporting from Iowa.
Exactly. It would be like reporting from Iowa. I mean, I had quite a bit of material, and I published all of it 2-3 weeks after I gathered it because none of it was time-sensitive. It was more, it's more of a monthly magazine kind of place than it is a wire agency place where, you know, wire agents or agency journalists will report on what blew up today or, you know, maybe, you know, the president of Iraq said something important and they'll report that. But that sort of thing just doesn't happen in the North. So there aren't very many journalists there, and it's understandable. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily, like a lot of people think, that there's this journalism agenda to paint Iraq in the most negative light possible. Although there does seem to be some of that, it's also just the way journalism is.
They paint everything in the most negative light possible.
They do, or some reporters do. But it's also just the way journalism works, at least because most journalists are wire agency reporters.
But they're running to the sound of the guns.
They are. That's kind of what their job is. Somebody has to do that, but it's just too bad that more people don't do the less sexy, violent, time-sensitive sort of reporting and get a little more in-depth. We see some of it, but not as much as I would like.
Yeah, I thought your dispatches from northern Iraq really would have fit nicely into like a New Yorker kind of article. I mean, they sort of had that kind of treatment and depth, and I guess that's what you mean when you said the monthly magazine. Maybe the New Yorker will send you back.
Yeah, there was a really terrific article in National Geographic this year in January about northern Iraq. And I only could find, I mean, the reporter and the photographer spent more time there than I did, but I can only find fault with one sentence in the whole piece.
Wow.
And it was quite long, and it was really terrific. Well, and that's really the sort of journalism that northern Iraq requires right now, is that.
Well, before we finish, any final words or suggestions or observations for people besides send money to MichaelTotten.com?
Well, the more money I can raise on the blog, the more of this sort of thing I can do in the future. And I definitely want to do more of it. Starting in a couple of days, I'm going to be writing some stories on my website about Israel and Palestine, which is where I went immediately after northern Iraq, before coming back to the United States. And it's going to be a bit of an experiment for me. I don't know if I'm going to be able to raise much money from doing that or not, because I raised a decent amount going to northern Iraq, where hardly any journalists go. And there are more foreign correspondents in Jerusalem than probably any other city in the world. So we'll see if that sort of thing works. But I will also say to anyone who already has a medium or large-sized blog readership that wants to go try to do what I've done, go do it. I raised more money than I thought I would. I didn't expect to make very much at all. But I did make enough, and I'm the fourth person who's made enough. So I'm sure there can be a fifth. And there's got to be somebody else out there who's thinking about doing this, and I would say go for it. Do it.
Go for it. Well, that's good advice. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, hey, thanks, Glenn. Thank you, Helen.
Thank you very much.
Well, that was all really interesting stuff. You know, maybe we should go and do some podcasts from Iraq or Iran. Maybe we should go to Iran and you could lead one of those women's revolutions Jim Dunnigan was talking about while you're there.
Yeah, I think those moral police they were talking about would have me in jail in about 2 minutes.
You know, I think you and morals police are just a bad mix.
I'd say so, but I'd love to lead a revolution like that. Somebody needs to.
Well, maybe some of the feminist groups in the United States will get behind it. It seems like it'd be right up their alley.
Oh, sure. Especially the academic feminists.
I'm just holding my breath. Well, we hope you enjoyed this podcast. We'll be back whenever we feel like it. You can check for updates on our websites, instapundit.com and drhelen.blogspot.com, or you can subscribe via iTunes. We like it when you do that.
And you might want to check out MichaelTotten.com and StrategyPage.com for more from our guests today. We'll be back sometime. In the meantime, have fun on the Internet.
Talk to you next time.